We're nearing the end of the rains. For many of you who made vows or determinations for the rains, the end is in sight. You're in the home stretch and the race. And many of you may be thinking that once the race is over, you don't have to worry about your determination anymore. But you have to remember something that Ajahn Mun taught to Ajahn Chah one time, which is that you have to make your practice in the shape of a circle. In other words, it's a year-round thing. It's not something you do only during the rains, because it's not the case that your defilements are of trouble only during the rains. They can make trouble any time of the year, and you have to be ready for them at any time of the year. So today I'd like to talk about making more permanent determinations. A determination in the shape of a circle, that something you're going to follow all the way around through the course of the year. In particular, I'd like to recommend taking the Brahma Viharas on as a determination. It's important that you realize that they are a determination. The Buddha talks about it as a form of mindfulness, something you have to keep in mind, and you have to be determined on them. It's not the case that universal goodwill, universal compassion, empathetic joy, or equanimity come to us naturally. They're called Brahma Viharas for a reason. They're attitudes of Brahmas. Our attitudes as human beings tend to be more partial. We have goodwill for the people who have been good to us, and maybe ill will for people who we don't like, who've been bad to us, or people we love, or people we are concerned about. And it takes an effort to have goodwill for everybody. The same with compassion, empathetic joy, the same with equanimity. So to think of these things as determinations, one, it's good to think back on what the Buddha himself had to say about determination. The word determination means you have an overriding desire that overcomes all the other things that would get in the way of the practice. In this case, your desire is aimed at practicing. And it's good to have that kind of desire. A Brahmin once came to see Ananda, who was staying in a park. And he asked him, this practice you're doing, what is it for? And Ananda said, well, one of the things it's for is for this ending of desire. And the Brahmin said, is there a path of practice that leads to the ending of desire? And Ananda said, yes, there is. And he quoted the four itibanas, the four bases for success. Concentration based on desire, concentration based on effort or persistence, concentration based on intent, and concentration based on the powers of analysis in the mind. And the Brahmin said, well, in that case, it's impossible. It's going to be an endless path because there's no way you can end desire through desire. And then I said, well, let me ask you some questions. Before you came to this park, didn't you have a desire to come to the park? Yes. Did you have an effort to come to the park? Yes. What happened to that desire and effort when you got here? And the Brahmin said, well, they've been allayed. And then I said, in the same way, as you're practicing, there has to be desire, there has to be effort. And once you get to the end of the path, that's when you put down the desire and put down the effort. In the meantime, don't abandon desire in the middle of the stream. Think about the Buddha's image of a raft. You're taking a raft across the stream, and you have to hold on. The raft is made out of twigs and branches you find on this shore. You're trying to get to the safety of the other shore. But there's no Nibbana raft that's going to come over and pick you up, or a Nibbana yacht, or a Nibbana bridge that's going to come over and pick you up. You've got to make the raft over what you've got on this side of the river, which stands for the various aggregates you have here, including your desires. You do your best to make a good raft, and then you hold on tight. You don't make a show of letting go as you cross the river because you get swept downstream. So you hold on tight and you make an effort with your hands and your feet. When you get to the other side, that's when you can put the raft down and your efforts and go on your way. So desire is an important part of the path, but it has to be an overriding desire because you have so many other desires as you go through the day. And it's good to have some desires to which you give priority. And that's what determination is all about. You say, these desires are going to be more important than the other ones that may come up in the course of the day, in the course of a week or a year or whatever. These are the determinations. The Buddha says there are four. There's determination on truth, determination on discernment, determination for truth, determination for relinquishment, and determination for calm. Discernment, truth, relinquishment, calm. Now he says these determinations are met when you attain the goal. In other words, Nibbana is the highest noble truth. The discernment that gets you there the relinquishment that gets you there. Those are the highest forms of discernment. Those are the highest forms of relinquishment. And Nirvana, of course, itself is the ultimate calm. But it's not just things that you find at the end of the path. These are qualities you want to develop all the way along the path. As the Buddha says, you try to not neglect discernment. We'll talk about it, what that means. You try to safeguard the truth. You're devoted to relinquishment, and you practice only for calm. Those are things that you do as you go through the day. Those are the desires that you want to have to overcome the other ones, because they come into conflict with other desires that you have, desires that are ignorant, deceptive, grasping, agitated. This is why the Buddha uses so many martial metaphors in his description of the path. You're like a soldier who has to be brave in the face of a battle. You have to build a fortress that you defend with your mindfulness, you defend with your discernment, you defend with your energy. You feed the soldiers and you feed your mindfulness with concentration. It's because it's going to be a struggle inside. And you can't let the desires that would pull you off the path gain the upper hand. You have to keep your determination at having the upper hand. And we see that these determinations go against the habits of the world. One of the habits is going for quick results without any thought for the long-term consequences. There's a habit of using deceit when you can't get what you want through honest means. There's the habit of trying to accumulate as much as you can. And there's a habit of looking for happiness in variety, excitement, and change for the sake of change. Those are the ways of the world, and we've been trained in the world in these ways for so long. It's going to take a real act of will to go against them. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about what's involved, say, in any determination. When you decide that you're going to determine on the path. To begin with, you have to start with discernment. That basically means, one, choosing a good goal, and then two, being wise and discerning in how you go about trying to find that goal. The Buddha himself said, discernment begins with a question. What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term harm and suffering? What, when I do it, will lead to my long-term wealth and happiness? And so do not neglect discernment means you're going to think about the long term. What are the long term consequences of what I do? And notice the emphasis there on what I do. It's going to be a path that you have to do. You have to be responsible for it. You can't tell yourself, well, I'm just going to have a sense of no self and not worry about it and let the path unfold on its own. And well, it's not going to unfold on its own. You have to take responsibility for it. The Buddha himself talks in these terms. He never said that there is no self. Of course, he never said there was a self. But he says you hang on to your idea of self as a strategy for happiness. And you also have the idea of not self as a strategy for happiness. And you learn how to use both of those wisely as part of the path. Your idea of your sense of self on the path plays three roles. A little bit of background. You have to remember that we have many senses of self inside. They're all focused on different desires. So here again, there's going to be a struggle between your many selves. But you're looking for, but they all tend to fall into three types. There's the self that wants something, that wants to enjoy the results of your actions. There's the self that's going to be responsible for your actions. The first one you can call the self as the consumer. The second one is the self as the producer. And the third one is the self as commentator, observer, the one who watches what the other two are doing, making sure that the sense of self as the consumer has high standards, and the self, sense of self as the producer is actually acting in line with the path. And these are going to be important roles that you're going to need in the path itself. With the self as the consumer, the Buddha says, there are times when you can feel discouraged in the path where you have to remind yourself, I got onto this path because I loved myself. I wanted to put an end to suffering. And if I stop practicing, does that mean I don't love myself anymore? So the idea of the self that would keep you on the path, that's the self that you want to maintain. And the self as producer, you have to feel that you are competent to do this. You're willing to take on the responsibility. Here, there's that story of Ananda teaching the nun. There was a nun who was really attracted to Ananda. And she thought one way to his heart would be to pretend that she was sick. So she sends word that she's sick and she'd like to hear a Dhamma teaching from Ananda. He comes and sees her. And he tells her four things. One, this body is something that we have to get beyond. One of the purposes of the practice is to go beyond the body, but we have to use the body in order to get there. We want to get beyond craving, but we have to use craving in order to get there. We have to use conceit, but we need to use conceit in order to get there. And we have to go beyond sexual intercourse, and there's no road for sexual intercourse at all. And so the nun had to apologize. But when the nun said that we need conceit, it basically, conceit in his sermon means that when you think that other people can do this, they're human beings. I'm a human being. If they can do it, why can't I? That is a type of conceit. There's a sense of I am in there. But it's the I am that will be responsible. So you need to nourish that I am. And finally, the self as commentator. This you get in the Buddha's instructions to Rahula. When he taught Rahula when Rahula was seven. Basically to scrutinize his actions. Starting with his intention. When you intend to do an act, what do you expect to be the results? If you think there's going to be any harm either to yourself or others, you don't do it. If you don't see any harm, you go ahead and do it. While you're doing it, you check to see what the results are coming up, because sometimes your actions will yield their results right away. It's not that you have to wait for the next lifetime. You put your hand in a fire, it's not going to burn you the next lifetime, it's going to burn right now. So if you see that you are giving rise to harm that you didn't expect, you stop. You see no harm, you can continue. And then finally, at the end, when the action is done, you look at the results. And if you did cause harm, you resolve not to repeat that mistake, and you go talk it over with someone who is more advanced on the path. If you didn't cause any harm, you take joy in the fact that you're training well, and you continue in the training. You know, throughout all those instructions to Rahula, the Buddha keeps telling Rahula to say, this action that I want to do, this action that I am doing, this action that I have done, I, you're taking responsibility. And you should learn how to find some joy in being responsible. After all, we act as agents. And there's a joy in being an agent when you're actually able to make change in the world. If we weren't agents, if we were just cogs in this karma machine, we'd have no role at all. If the karma machine was going to produce suffering, we'd have to just put up with the suffering and that would be it. There was a psychologist who was researching infants back in the beginning of the last century. And he noticed that the things that the infants like find their most joy in is when they find they can do something again and again and again and they get the same results. This is one of the things that drives us crazy about little kids, right? They make a noise, and they don't stop. And they're finding joy in that because they realize they figured out cause and effect, at least in that one area, and that they can be responsible. They see themselves as agents. And the Buddha is saying, don't deny yourself the joy of that agency. Learn how to use it well on the path. So this is a lot of discernment, is realizing that you have to be responsible, and you want to be responsible in a way that you're thinking about the long term. As the Buddha said, one of your measures of your discernment is when you see that there's an action that you like to do, but it's going to give bad results. Or you see there's an action that you don't like to do, but will give good results. You get yourself to do the action that will give good results, whether you like it or not. You learn how to want to do that action. You learn how to want not to do the action that you like, but will give bad results. This involves, of course, talking to yourself, figuring out what motivates you. And in doing this, you're going to learn a lot about your mind, what motivation works, what motivation doesn't work. Discernment in following the goal and pursuing the goal also means that you figure out when something is really difficult, how you can tackle a difficult problem. You learn how to break it down into small steps, so it's not so overwhelming all at once. You take it one step at a time. I found that when I'm doing a project that seems daunting and I put it off for a couple of days, the best way to get started is to work on it the last 5 minutes during the time I allot for my working. So I don't expect too much, but it gives me a little bit of momentum so I can pick it up the next day and I'm already in the process. So I've got some momentum going there. So you learn how to build up your momentum so it's headed in the right direction. All this is part of discernment. Learning how to use your wisdom in choosing a good goal and learning how to use your wisdom in how you go about pursuing it. The second determination is truth. This basically comes down to what the Buddha called the two factors that nourish the Dharma, which is one, you commit to doing it, and then two, you reflect to see what results you're actually getting, like he talked to Rahula. Because in teaching Rahul, he was not only teaching him discernment, he was also teaching him how to be truthful. You try to do the practice as best you can, and then you learn from the results. You reflect on them and you say, okay, where can I improve this? What can be better? As the Buddha himself said, that one of the secrets to his awakening was he did not let himself be content with his skillful qualities. Now, it may sound strange, because we know the Buddha talks so much about contentment. For him, contentment is a matter of being content with whatever food, clothing, shelter you get. But as for qualities in your mind, if there's something unskillful in the mind, of course you want to get rid of it. But even if there are skillful qualities, you say, don't let yourself just rest with them. After all, that's what enabled him to become the Buddha. He didn't rest parts of the path where other people have rested in the past. So you reflect and say, where can I do this better? Now, you don't want to drive yourself crazy, holding yourself to a standard that you're not able to maintain. But try to figure out what stretches you. And stretch yourself a little bit, stretch yourself a little bit more, stretch yourself a little bit more. That's how you grow. So, of course, this means that you do have the desire to change things. I don't know how many times you hear it said, well, the Buddha said the desire to change things, desire for things to be different from what they are, is a form of craving, therefore you should give up on desires. That's not how the Buddha found awakening. You're true to your desire for awakening, and then you have to use your discernment to figure out what really works. You can think of the Buddha's image of the cow. You want to get milk out of the cow. If you take the wrong approach, you're not going to get the milk. And the wrong approach, he said, is trying to twist the horn. You twist the horn, there's no milk. You twist the horn a little bit more, there's no milk. Twist it a little bit more, there's no milk. Then you realize you should just stop twisting the horn. And some people say, okay, that's good. I'm not twisting the horn, I'm relaxed, the cow is not being harassed. The problem is that you're not getting any milk. There is a right approach, it's just a matter of realize, okay, I was taking the wrong approach, but I've got to make the effort to find the right approach. Because if you just let yourself rest there, you're not going to get any milk, even though there is milk in the cow. In the same way, if you just say, I'm not going to do anything, I'm not going to have any desires, okay, it may be peaceful for a while, but nibbana is there, and it's not to be found just by being peaceful. It's by figuring out what the causes are and actually being able to do them. So that's a quality of truthfulness. You really stick to what you see is the way to lead to the goal that you want. As for the third quality, relinquishment, you have to realize that when you set your mind on one goal or set your heart on a goal, there are other things you're going to have to give up. Think about playing chess. If you want to keep all your pieces, you're not going to win at chess. You have to be willing to sacrifice them. Back when I was in Thailand, I was taking what they call the Naktam exams, the Dharma exams that they give to the monks. One of the parts of the exam was that they would give you passages from the Buddhist texts that you had to memorize. And then they were going to ask you to write a little Dharma talk. And in the course of the Dharma talk, they would choose the topic, and you had to bring in a passage that would be relevant to that topic. The first year you had to bring in one passage, the second year you had to bring in two, the third year you had to bring in three. And it would build up to the exam. All these little novices were just memorizing page after page after page of these sayings. And I realized, okay, I can't compete with the novices on that front because my education wasn't involved in too much memorization. So I figured the best approach would be to memorize two or three really basic Dharma quotes that you use in any situation. And I found that one of them was this. If you see that there is a higher less happiness that comes from forsaking a lesser happiness, the wise person will be willing to forsake the lesser happiness for the sake of the higher one. So it's a trade. As I said, I used this quote for all 3 years in the exam. But it is a trade. Relinquishment is not just giving up. You're realizing that you have to give up certain things if you want a higher pleasure. It's like planting a garden. You may like eucalyptus trees, but eucalyptus trees are going to kill everything else in your garden. So you have to keep those out of the garden to get the other plants that you want. Now, to let go requires not just saying, okay, I've got to let go of something. That's not going to work. You let it go and it's going to come back because you don't understand it. To understand it, you have to ask yourself, well, what is the allure of this thing? Why am I attracted to it? Say that you have a habit of getting angry, and part of you says, this is a horrible habit, I don't like it. But there must be some part of you that finds it alluring. There's an appeal to the anger, and you have to see that. sometimes this requires a lot of digging deep inside because it goes down layers of things that we don't like to admit about ourselves. But unless you see the allure, and then you can compare it with the drawbacks, you realize, okay, the allure is not worth it. Only then can you let it go. So that's what relinquishing means. It's basically a trade. Finally, calm. Calm is a goal in the path, but it's also something that you use. Part of the calm, of course, is the calm of concentration. Part of the calm is the calm of equanimity and patience, endurance. Now, patient endurance doesn't mean you just sit there and wait for things to happen. It means that if there's a task you have to do, and it's going to be a long-term task, you learn how to talk to yourself into enjoying it all along the way. There was a famous case in Canada back in the 19th century. There was an Englishman who trusted his life to a group of Dene Indians who were going to go across the Northwest Territories. And it was in the winter, and they would go hunting as they went along, and there's some days when the hunting just did not produce anything at all. He noticed those were the days when the Dene joked with one another a lot. In other words, they made light of a difficult situation. So part of being calm is learning how to keep yourself in a good mood as you're struggling on the path. Knowing how to talk yourself into being happy that you're doing this, and that you're confident that you're on the right path. So those are the four determinations in general. Determination on discernment, truth, relinquishment, and calm. You use your discernment and figure out what is a good goal, realizing that you want to work for the long-term happiness, not just short-term. Then you're true to that in sticking to what will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. You relinquish from anything that would get in the way, all the lesser pleasures that get in the way of the practice. And you have the calm that comes with confidence that you're doing something good and that you're going to be able to stick with it over the long term. So those are the qualities that the Buddha would have you develop in every aspect of the path. As for the Brahmaviharas, as I said earlier, the Brahmaviharas are something you have to be determined on. The Buddha never said that it's part of your innate nature, that you would have universal goodwill for everybody. It's something you have to work on, because there are going to be lots and lots of difficult people out there, and you still have to have goodwill for them. His image is of bandits. They've pinned you down. They've got a two-handled saw, and they're cutting you up into little pieces. He said, even in that case, you have to have metta for them. He says, keep this image in mind, so that when other people are difficult, when other people do horrible things, you say, well, at least they're not cutting me up into bits and pieces. And even if they are, you say, to practice the Buddha's teachings, I've got to learn how to have goodwill for them. And of course, it doesn't mean you like them. You don't approve of what they're doing. And basically, goodwill in that situation would be, may these bandits see the error of their ways and stop doing things like this. So when we apply the determinations to develop these Brahmaviharas, first we have to think about, well, what do the Brahmaviharas mean? Start with metta. Sometimes it's translated as love or loving kindness, but there's another word in Pali for love, bhema, and the Buddha says love is not reliable. If you love somebody and someone else treats that person well, you're going to like the second person, regardless of how good that person is otherwise. If someone mistreats the person you love, you're going to hate that second person. This is for somebody you hate. If somebody treats somebody you hate well, you're going to hate that person too. Or if they mistreat the person you hate, you're going to like them. You can't trust love at all, because it's partial. The goodwill is basically a wish for happiness. Doesn't require love at all. Think of the chant that the Buddha has you have, chant for snakes. You're trying to protect yourself from snakes, you have goodwill for all the different kinds of snakes. Beings with no feet, beings with 2 feet, 4 feet, many feet. And then you say, may they go away. In other words, you realize, okay, that there are some beings out there that it's better for both sides if you live apart. So you're not going to be there for them. You want them to be there for themselves. When the Buddha talks about how you talk to yourself about metta, you say, may these beings not despise one another or mistreat one another. In other words, may they create good karma for themselves. Because what you're doing when you extend goodwill to somebody Basically, it's a form of respect. I've heard some people say that metta means I accept you. People need more than just acceptance, and metta means more than acceptance. It means that you have respect for the other person's desire for true happiness and respect for the rule of the laws of karma, the principles of karma. That's something else entirely. And whatever that person's going to do that aims at true happiness, you want to respect that. And if you realize that some of their aims are not in line with the principles of karma, okay, you respect the principle of karma. What this means is if someone is misbehaving, your attitude is, may they see the error of their ways and voluntarily abandon them. You don't have to go for punishment first. Because you have to ask yourself, and this is where you get into the truthfulness of metta. If there's somebody out there that you have ill will for, what do you gain by seeing someone else suffer? What would the world gain by seeing them suffer? Sometimes we say, well, the criminals won't see the error of their ways unless you punish them a lot. Well, a lot of criminals just get more hardened in their ways through the punishment. They don't see that they did anything wrong. The more you punish them, the more they insist on the fact that they didn't do anything wrong. So the truly good result, the good approach would be wishing for everybody to see voluntarily what is really the cause for true happiness and be willing and able to act on it. So it's good to understand what metta means, because that means then when someone really is behaving in a despicable way, you can have metta for them without being hypocritical. You're not just saying, I love you, I love you, I love, because you don't love them. But you do respect that someplace in that person there's a desire for happiness. It's just really, really deluded. If there's any way you can help get rid of the delusion, you're happy to do it. If it's not, well, that's when you go to the equanimity, as the other Brahma-vihara. So as I said, goodwill requires respect for the principle of karma. And that does that in two ways. One is in understanding what metta means. And secondly is understanding what you have to do in order to create an attitude of metta or goodwill. And what it says, you have to fabricate this. And it talks about three kinds of fabrication of any emotion. One is through the way you breathe, that's bodily fabrication. Second is the way you talk to yourself, called directed thought and evaluation. That's verbal fabrication. This is your inner conversation. And finally, there are perceptions and feelings, the images you hold in mind that tell you the meaning of something or the identity of something. And then feeling tones of pleasure or pain, neither pleasure nor pain. All our emotions are composed of these three factors. And so if you have trouble developing a feeling of goodwill for someone or an attitude of goodwill, you ask yourself, what can I do to change the way I'm breathing? What can I do to change the way I'm talking to myself? What can I do to change the perceptions I hold in mind? And the Buddha provides you with lots of perceptions. You may have read the passage where the Buddha says, you know, just as a mother protects her only child, so you should protect your attitude of metta. Sometimes that's mistranslated as just as a mother cherishes her child, you should cherish all beings. The Buddha never said that. He says you protect your metta as a mother would protect her child with her life. Well, think back again on the bandits. They're sawing you to little pieces. And if you let your heart give in to ill will, you're going to have a bad rebirth. A rebirth focused on revenge. And that's not a good birth to have. So for your own sake, you have to have goodwill. So that's how, just as a mother would protect her child with her life, in other words, be willing to sacrifice her life. Especially think back in those days, when if a woman had one child, that was her future insurance. So whether she loved the child or not, she was going to protect the child. So in the same way, you have to protect your goodwill in all situations. So that's one image she has you hold in mind. Another image he has you hold in mind is you try to make your goodwill as large and solid as the earth. So no matter what anyone else does to you, he says, look at it as a man who comes along with a little basket and a hoe. He says, be without earth, be without earth. And he digs here and he digs there and he spits here and spits there and urinates here, urinates there. And his efforts are pathetic because the earth is so much bigger. You've got to make your attitude of goodwill and endurance that much larger. Think of it as being that large, no matter what anybody does. You're going to maintain that because you're doing it. You're developing goodwill for your own protection. Because if you have ill will for anybody, you're going to be acting in unskillful ways around that person. So you want to maintain your goodwill. You want it to be as large and as independent as possible. Sometimes we hear the idea that having an independent self is a bad thing, but if your goodness can be independent, then you can begin to rely on it. If it's dependent on other people being good to you, it's nothing really special about it. It's certainly not a Brahma attitude. So those are some of the ways in which you use your discernment to develop goodwill. As for truth, you basically have to carry through. And one of the ways of carrying through, of course, is through your own practice of trying to find true happiness. You learn exactly, well, how is it actually, what true happiness is, how is it found? So that way you can talk to other people about true happiness, you can try to influence them in the right direction. You know what you're talking about. So it's not just being nice to other people. You have to find in yourself, what is true happiness like? How is it found? Then you can give proper advice to other people. You can be a good influence on other people. You can also think of compassion and empathetic joy as being kind of tests for your goodwill. In other words, you see somebody who's suffering, and say they've done something nasty to you in the past, can you still have compassion for that person? Or if someone is happy, but they're doing things that you don't like, can you still be happy for that person? Here you are saying, may all beings be happy, and then here you come across someone who's happy and you don't like it. Then the question is, how honest and how true are you in your goodwill? You have to learn how to talk to yourself, that you remind yourself that your goodness is not made less by someone else's happiness. And remember what the Buddha said about seeing people who are suffering. You don't look down on them. You remind yourself, I've been there too. Imagine just the poorest people you can see. You've been there. Years back when I was in India, it was right at the very beginning of the rains retreat, or the beginning of the actual rains, excuse me. And I was doing walking meditation after the rains had stopped that first day on top of a building. And I was looking out across the fence, and on the other side of the fence there was this tiny, tiny farm with this tiny, tiny little house. And as the rain stopped, this family came pouring out of the house. I mean, five generations. They also went to work starting on their field. They had no animals to drive the plow, so they had the teenage boys pulling the plow. And the old great-grandmother and grandfather were bent over picking up little rocks and things out of the way. And it just struck me, how many people there were in that tiny house or that tiny field, how poor they were. And something welled up inside me and said, do you know how many times you've been through that yourself? That's been you many, many times. So when you see somebody who's poor, don't look down on them for having bad karma. Remember, you've been there too. The same with someone who's wealthy, powerful, beautiful, popular. You've been there too. And see how fragile that is. You are now where you are. So you're not lessened by anybody else's good fortune. So you say, may they continue to enjoy their good fortune, may they learn how to use it skillfully. That's the right attitude. As far as relinquishment, this is when you have to ask yourself, is there anybody out there that you have trouble saying, may this person see the error of their ways and be willing and able to act on that knowledge? Because there are some people who might say, well, I'd like to see that person suffer first. And as I said, you have to work through this. You have to ask yourself, what do you see that you would gain from that person suffering? And learn how to let it go. Then finally, calm. You know, you wish for all beings to find happiness. You know that a lot of people are not going to be changing their ways anytime soon. This is where you have to develop equanimity and patience. Now, equanimity is not simply saying, well, I'll just put up with whatever things are. That's just ordinary equanimity, what a John Fung would call small-hearted equanimity. The Buddha taught what John Fung called large-hearted equanimity, which is you create the causes for true happiness inside you, either through your practice of concentration or through your practice of insight. And then based on that sense of well-being, you can have equanimity for others in a way that's not defeatist. You've got your happiness taken care of. When you look around at others and say, I can't make my happiness depend on them because they're unreliable. So I've found something more reliable in myself. And because I'm no longer feeding on them, I can have equanimity for them. This doesn't mean that you give up your goodwill. You do still hope for them someday to change their ways. But if you realize that it's going to take time, you learn the patience and the endurance and the equanimity you're going to need. think of the Buddha himself. He found the happiness of the deathless, and then he was able to have equanimity for all beings, but that didn't mean he would just sit around and do nothing. He taught as best he could, as he said. When there were those who would listen to his teachings, he was satisfied, but his satisfaction didn't overcome his mind. When those who wouldn't follow what he has to say, he didn't let dissatisfaction overcome his mind. He had his source of well-being inside. So that's what we're working on, is finding this independent source of well-being inside. That's what determination on discernment, truth, relinquishment, and calm is all about. Because only when you're skillful in looking after your own true happiness can you be skillful in the ways you deal with other people. If you're still hungry, then your attitudes of what you're going to do for other people are based on hunger, which is not the right attitude. It's not really looking at them to see what they really need. That's not looking to yourself to see what you really need. The Buddha's teaching is based on the idea that true happiness is something found within, and therefore everybody can find true happiness and doesn't have to conflict. So these are some of the thoughts you might want to keep in mind as you determine on developing the Brahma Viharas as you go through the year. We talk so much about finding ways of bringing the practice into daily life. You want to make the Brahma Viharas your framework for the day so that you bring your daily life into the practice. Think of a John Mun. Every morning when he woke up, first thing he did, goodwill for all beings. After his afternoon nap, goodwill for all beings. Before he went to bed at night, goodwill for all beings. That was the framework for the day. And you want to make these attitudes the framework for your day. Because it's when you have goodwill for all beings, then you can trust yourself to act in ways that will be for your good and for theirs as well. However, that's going to work out. It depends on your discernment, on how you apply your goodwill in different situations. What's an appropriate way of helping people who are difficult? What's an appropriate way of helping people who are really impossible? Because you will meet up with people like that. But you have to learn how to maintain your goodwill in all situations so you're safe and the people around you are safe as well. So, those are my thoughts.